Arrow 2, the Arrow 3, the Patriot, the THAAD system. These are the systems that are designed to defend against those. The Iron Dome is when Hamas fires off, 70, unguided rockets that go against an area. The Iron Dome is designed to shoot those down, or if Hezbollah fires Katyusha rockets. But the Iron Dome isn't designed to take down ballistic missiles. There's other systems that are supposed to do that, and clearly those systems didn't work.
Does Israel have missiles that can reach Iran?
Oh, 100%. The Jericho 2, the Jericho 3 have the ability to reach Iran. But the difference is Israel's missiles aren't designed. They're not designed to do the kind of saturation attack that Iran just carried out. These are missiles that are one shot, one hit, potentially with nuclear capability. But if they're conventional, it's just designed to have one warhead come in. The question is, could the Russian S-400 air defense systems that Russia has supposedly provided Iran and are in position around Iran's critical infrastructure, can they get an intercept solution on a Jericho ballistic missile? And I think the answer might be yes. So even if Israel were to fire Jericho missiles, there's a good chance that because they are flying a conventional ballistic trajectory, that they could be shot down by the S-400.
What is Russia's role, as you understand it, in the defense of Iran, other than providing the defensive mechanisms that you just talked about? For example, would President Putin call up President Netanyahu or Prime Minister Netanyahu and say, back off? Or would the Russians provide offensive weaponry to enhance the Iranian fleet?
Well, I don't think there's anything the Iranians need or want from Russia in terms of offensive weapons capability. They've proven that they have significant strike capacity that successfully hit the most heavily defended space on the planet, which is Israel. Defense is a different matter altogether. I believe Russia has gone out of its way to provide Iran with the defensive capabilities. Again, speculation on my part, but I would imagine, given the timelines associated with training up an S-400 crew to be combat capable, that these missiles might be manned by Russian crews, or at least have Russian advisors on the ground. The same thing with electronic warfare systems in place, etc. Also, it appears that Russia may have delivered some of their more advanced fighters to Iran. And again, because the Iranians haven't had a chance to fully train up on these fighters may be flown by Russians. So theoretically speaking, if Israel were to launch a strike using manned aircraft against Iran, there's a chance they'll be going up against air defense systems manned by Russians and fighter interceptors manned by Russians. History shows that this is what Russia has done in the past. They did it in Vietnam, they did it in Korea, and they did it in Egypt during the Yom Kippur War and the War of Attrition. And there's no reason to believe that Russia wouldn't be doing that today.
We have a clip of President Biden in which he refers to Iran as defeated and ineffective. But in fairness to him, listen to the whole clip. It's not that long. It's maybe 30 seconds, and it's only about a half an hour old. Chris, cut number 21.
Say a few words about Iran's missile attack on Israel today. At my direction, the United States military actively supported the defense of Israel, and we're still assessing the impact. But based on what we know now, the attack appears to have been defeated and ineffective. And this is testament to Israeli military capability and U.S. military. It's also a testament to intensive planning between the United States and Israel to anticipate and defend against the brazen attack we expected.
First of all, what is your opinion of what President Biden just said, defeated and ineffective?
Well, I mean, his words don't match the video evidence that has been presented so far on Telegram, on X, on TV. Again, until a final battle damage assessment can be made, it's hard to say. One way an attack could be ineffective is if, for instance, Nevatim Air Base had been emptied of all critical assets, and literally the Iranians struck empty shelters. Then you could say it was ineffective. But what he's doing right now is classic American doublespeak. The United States does not want this to escalate at all. And the key aspect to escalation is the concept of deterrence, modes of deterrence. If Iran has done something that both Israel and the United States publicly say shows the ineffectiveness of Israel's defenses, Israel has lost any notion of deterrence, and stability goes along with that. I think the United States is anxious to keep Israel from over-escalation, meaning they know that Israel is going to retaliate. Iran knows Israel is going to retaliate. What the United States is trying to do is create a set of circumstances that allow Israel the ability to retaliate with a significant strike, but not something that prompts an immediate Iranian retaliation, and withdraw back to its borders, maintaining the fiction of effective missile defense, so that politically Netanyahu has some sort of cover to hide behind. And that's appears to what he's doing. I don't know how long this subterfuge, if indeed it is subterfuge, can last. There is commercially available satellite imagery. There's eventually we're going to get to know what was hit in Israel and how badly it was hit. The Iranians will publish a target list and the truth will come out. But I think right now Biden is desperately trying to contain a situation that has gone grossly out of control. The U.S. Navy did not stop this attack. It was supposed to, but it did not stop this attack. It did intercept a handful of missiles. But again, the Iranians have had some time now to figure out America's shipborne anti-missile defense protocols. And I would imagine that they did things designed to get the radars to lock on to certain targets, which were decoys, and then confuse the firing solution by mixing up the missiles coming in. And the end result was saturation, and it was the ineffectiveness was on the part of the Americas. Too many missiles hit the ground simultaneously for anybody to believe the notion that the United States and Israel had an effective defense.
Are United States defenses on the ground in Israel, or did they all come from naval ships, ships in the Mediterranean?
No, I believe that the United States has both. We have the ships, which provide the bulk of it in terms of the numbers, but we've also deployed one and maybe two THAAD batteries. THAAD are a more advanced intercept capability than the Patriot. We also may have some Patriot batteries on the ground, especially since we put American troops on the ground. We'll be protecting them with American assets. We would never allow American troops to be deployed and only have Israeli assets on them. We provide our own force protection. So, we have ground-based interceptors in Israel as well as the sea-based interceptors.
Is Netanyahu afraid? Is he scared?
It's hard for me to get into. I know he's fearful of his political future. He's somebody who's been saying he wants to have this decisive moment of conflict with Iran for some time now. I don't know what he's being briefed. I would imagine that if he's being briefed honestly, he should be afraid. He should be very afraid, because what the Iranians demonstrated today is that Israel is effectively defenseless in the face of a concerted Iranian attack, and that if the Iranians wanted to, they could time this attack differently. They timed it at night when facilities will be empty, when the Israelis would have had enough time to evacuate, put people in bomb shelters. If the Iranians wanted to pull an Israel, for instance, a Daiwa-type doctrine, which is Israel's doing against Lebanon right now, collective punishment of the Lebanese population for the sins of Hezbollah. Over 1,000 innocent Lebanese have been killed. I have friends of mine over there who are scared to death because of what's going on, and they are civilians. They have nothing to do with Hezbollah, nothing to do with anything, just living their lives, and yet their lives are at risk because of the irresponsible actions of Israel. If Iran were to replicate the Israeli approach and apply a collective punishment thing, they could easily have killed several thousand Israelis tonight, but they chose not to. They chose to strike military targets only, and they did so at a time when Israel would be able to evacuate and put people in. So this was not an attack designed to inflict casualties. This was an attack designed to send a very stark message that the next time you won't be so lucky. And the other thing they did, and this is something that should resonate with the Israelis, if indeed they took out Nevatim Air Base, which it appears that they struck many, many times, every Israeli pilot that takes off to strike Iran in the back of their head has to wonder whether or not there will be an air base waiting for them when they come home. Because what Iran did there can be, and that's the most heavily guarded air base that where the most valuable assets are, that can be replicated at every single air base in Israel. And the time of flight, 5 to 15 minutes. It takes the Israeli Air Force far longer. So by the time the Iranians detect the Israeli Air Force being launched against them, they will detect it. The Russians will detect it. They'll get the early warning. They could literally saturate these air bases and there won't be any airfields left in Israel for these aircraft to return to.
What is Prime Minister Netanyahu doing to Israel? Big picture.
Well, he's killed Israel. I mean, I think strategically Israel's finished. You know, what we're looking at right now is noise. The key thing we have to look at is long-term economic viability, because from that comes social stability, political stability, military security. You know, we're in a situation right now where Netanyahu has launched a conflict against Hezbollah. Iran just put a marker on it saying, we're not going to let you destroy Hezbollah. We're not going to let you go in that direction. The purpose of this conflict was to return 60,000 Israelis to their settlers, to their homes in the north of Israel. They'll never be able to return home now. It just isn't going to happen, void of a comprehensive peace settlement, which will cost Netanyahu's job because it'll be inclusive of a ceasefire agreement with Hamas, which he said will never happen. So, you know, Netanyahu has basically sacrificed Israel for his own personal political ambition. He desperately wants to, you know, leave office with a legacy of that of a winner, a victor. This is the ultimate sin of a narcissist full of hubris. And that's who Benjamin Netanyahu is. And he sacrificed the long-term viability of Israel because their economy is in tatters right now. They're never going to get the 60,000 back. The port of Eilat is shut down. That's costing them billions. Haifa's under attack. That's not an effective port. Ashkelon gas facility was struck. That's an energy problem for Israel. You know, Israel is unsustainable economically and unsustainable right now in terms of their social reality. Politically, you have an evenly divided country. I again remind people that prior to October 7th, the Israeli president was speaking of civil war, and those emotions still run high. This is all because of Benjamin Netanyahu. He has destroyed Israel, destroyed Israel's long-term viability, and he's sacrificing everything just so that he can retain a legacy that's already tarnished. He will never recover from this. He will always be a genocidal, murderous maniac, a man who killed Hind Rajab. That's what I will forever remember him as, the man who murdered a six-year-old girl who was desperately crying for help. And there's no forgiving this.
I was surprised to hear you say, because I haven't heard anybody else report it, that the Jordanians provided defenses for the Israelis and boasted about it. Isn't the king of Jordan on thin ice with his own people? I realize he's a king, he's a monarch, he probably has limitless power within the Hashemite kingdom, but isn't he really going against the grain to have his military do that?
He has no choice. He sold his soul a long time ago to Israel and to the United States. He functions as an extension of the Israeli security apparatus. Jordan is a shield to Israel, and one of the shields they provide is suppression of Palestinian statehood. Jordan, the King of Jordan, is not supportive of a Palestinian homeland. He's fearful of the Palestinian people. He is, of course, walking a thin line, as you said, right now, because the emotions in the region lend itself to support for Palestine. His wife is Palestinian, but at the end of the day, you know, he will do what he is conditioned to do. His Pavlovian response is when threats emerge to Israel, Jordan's job is to eliminate the threats that Jordan is capable of doing. His missiles did shoot down a number, when I say a number, one, two, three of Iran's missiles. One of the debris from one of those shoot downs landed in a Palestinian village, killing a Palestinian individual. But, you know, again, the King of Jordan is a man who I think is widely reviled amongst the Palestinian people, even his own people, and in the Arab world, is a man who sold out to Israel a long time ago.
Last question, President Erdogan of Turkey, is the, in your view, the assassination of Nasrallah enough to get him to do something, whether it's militarily or economically? All he has to do is make a phone call and turn off the spigot of oil that goes to Israel, no?
Yeah, he doesn't even have to make a phone call. He just does it. I mean, it's Turkish pipelines. He doesn't have to clear it with Azerbaijan, although he and Azerbaijan they're very good allies. And, you know, that's what makes it difficult is Azerbaijan. This is an important, you know, economic and geopolitical thing. And also remember, Turkey wants to preserve its potential as a regional gas hub. And you can't be a regional gas hub. The key thing to energy security, and this is what people tend to forget, is the moment you start turning on and off pipelines because of geopolitical pressure, you're no longer a reliable source of energy security. To be a supplier of energy, you supply energy come hell or high water. You know, this is what Russia's done. I mean, there's a lot of people before the Ukraine conflict that said that Russia would weaponize its energy. Russia never weaponized. Russia has met every single contract because that's what you have to do to be a reliable supplier of energy. Azerbaijan desires to be a reliable supplier of energy, and Turkey desires to be a regional energy hub, which means you have to be a reliable supplier of energy. So anybody waiting for him to shut down the oil, you got to think strategically and understand that's not something Turkey's going to do. And until Turkey is willing to do that, I think we have to take at face value, you know, any rhetoric that comes from Erdogan about confronting Israel. Turkey has a military capable of confronting Israel. If it chose to do so, it will not do so. This is just posturing by Erdogan.
Scotty, I can't thank you enough. We put this show together the last minute in light of your schedule and mine, and in light of the events in the Middle East. This is the largest audience you've ever had, and it is the largest live audience we've ever had. So before I let you go, I know Scott agrees with me. Please like and subscribe to Judging Freedom. Help us spread the word. This is the top of the heap right here, my dear friend Scott Ritter. Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Coming up tomorrow, another champion at 11 o'clock in the morning, Colonel Douglas McGregor at noon, live from Ukraine, and he'll get through this time. Patrick Lancaster at 1:30 in the afternoon, Aaron Mate at 2 in the afternoon, Phil Giraldi. It's been a long day. Thank you for watching. Judge Napolitano for Judging Freedom.
الجنوب لكي يقاوم إن تاريخ الإباء غير نائم يكتب عن أرضنا أرض الملاحم هذا ما اشتكى بالمذلة والهزائم حينما هب الجنوب لكي يقاوم إن تاريخ الإباء غير نائم يكتب عن أرضنا أرض الملاحم إني أهل العزم إن تدعى العزائم هذا سيفي بالوغى بالموت قائم إن شعبي كل أحبائي أحبائي مثل ما قلتم رجال الله في الميدان ووعد صادق أنتم وأنتم نصرنا الآتي وأنتم من جبال الشمس عاتية على العادي
وعد صادق أنتم
وأنتم نصرنا الآتي
وأنتم من جبال الشمس عاتية
أحبائي أحبائي بكم يتحرر الأسرى بكم تتحرر الأرض بهبطتكم بهبطتكم يصان البيت والأرض
بكم يتحرر الأسرى بكم تتحرر الأرض بغطتكم
يصان البيت والأرض بحرارة أنتم وأنتم نهضة القيم هنا بحرارة أنتم وأنتم نهضة القيم وأنتم خالدون كما خلود الأرز في القمم
This Saturday, October the 5th, there will be a national summit on gun violence and racism in person at the Metropolitan AME Church, 1518 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., and online at forsummit.org. The summit is a unique, solution-driven gathering of activists from D.C. and across the country, sharing policies and strategies successful in reducing violence and saving lives. The event is sponsored by the Fellowship of the Reconciliation under the leadership of Reverend Hagler with many others. Registration is at forsummit.org. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, October 2nd. Here are some headlines. Vice presidential candidates J.D. Vance and Tim Walz faced off last night in their first and only debate of the 2024 campaign. The event was widely noted for its civility and focus on policy, as the two candidates differed on a range of issues, from abortion to immigration to health care and democracy. Senator Vance defended Donald Trump's position that abortion regulation should be left up to the states. Governor Walz disagreed, saying abortion is a basic human right. On immigration, Vance blamed Kamala Harris for the number of migrants who have crossed the border under the Biden administration, while Walz called for immigration reform and criticized Trump for blocking bipartisan solutions. On the issue of democracy, Vance was pressed on his past comments that he wouldn't have certified the results of the 2020 election and refused to explicitly back down.
This was a threat to our democracy in a way that we had not seen. And it manifested itself because of Donald Trump's inability to say. He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
It's a damning non-answer for you to not talk about censorship.
When asked if they would support or oppose a preemptive strike on Iran by Israel, both candidates cited Israel's right to defend itself without directly answering the question. In other news, yesterday, Iran launched at least 180 ballistic missiles at Israel in what it called an act of self-defense against Israel's aggressive actions. Israel promised what it called a painful retaliation, which could include attacks on Iranian oil production, according to Axios. The UN reported one death, a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank, from Iran's missile attack, which came hours after Israel launched a limited ground invasion of southern Lebanon. A Pentagon statement said most missiles were intercepted with assistance from U.S. ships based in the region. Meanwhile, fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed Hezbollah continued in southern Lebanon today, according to statements from both sides. Israel reported 8 soldiers killed in combat and said it will send additional infantry and armored units into the fight. Separately, an Israeli air and ground attack launched earlier today in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis has killed at least 51 and injured 82 people. And the Justice Department announced yesterday it plans to launch a review of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, considered one of the worst single acts of violence against black people in the United States. The massacre started on May 31st, 1921, when white attackers killed as many as 300 people, most of them black, in Tulsa's prosperous Greenwood neighborhood, which had gained the nickname of Black Wall Street. DOJ will probe the killings under the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act, which gives the federal government the power to reopen civil rights-related cold cases, while it is unlikely that there is anyone living who could be prosecuted as a result of the inquiry. The announcement of a first-ever federal probe into the massacre was embraced by descendants of survivors, who have long criticized city and state leaders for not doing more to compensate those affected by the attack. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Beneath the silver sky, moon. the rhythm soaring. Living, loving, laughing, we will fly. Oh, sister, can't you see?
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, WPFW listening family and listeners and supporters and worldwide. I am Andrea, your diva here in Sophie's Parlor, and it's such a pleasure to join you this afternoon in the parlor. Today, I wanted to honor with gratitude a show that has been put together entitled The Power We Seek. As many of you know, October is the month that we honor and are speaking about domestic violence awareness. And today we're going to bring you the many aspects of power that all humans can inhibit. And instead of seeing an issue like domestic violence, as seeing something where there's powerlessness, we want to uplift that power today and all that every human being has to overcome what seems like something that's very insurmountable, especially in the times when you're in a domestic violence situation. So we are glad you've come into the parlor this Wednesday, and we are going to journey together. And throughout the show, I'll just give you some facts and information that I've found about domestic violence. And again, this is really empowering us that even when you're in a situation that seems very hopeless, like a domestic violence relationship or situation, there are things that you can do to empower yourself and to move through it. And that's what we're exploring today. I want you all to get cozy, get your cup of tea, your cup of cider. If you want to put something extra in it, that's quite all right, because that weather outside is getting a little fallish. All these things here and so much more in Sophie's Parlor here on WPFW. And again, Sophie's is a show by women, about women, but it's for everybody. Let's get into that music. This first segment is We Seek Friends.
We've come a long way to be
Through thick and thin, winter, spring, summer, or fall. All you have to do is call, and I'll be there. You've got a friend. Know that you've got a friend when people